today is about putting out fires, not lighting fires. I awoke at 2:30 in the morning a couple of days ago, which is not unusual for a man my age. And what may be unusual is that I sleep with an NPR implant, which is a radio that has an earphone for private listening, meaning listening that doesn't disturb my wife. And I got almost immediate word of what had happened in London and the terror attacks in London. And it is an intimation of hell. We know what hell is. There's an archetypal image of the terror of hell. It is underground. It is on fire. There are agonal screams of human beings in dread, in fear, in pain, and in terror, and it is contagious. The humanity of the people dying, the inhumanity of the people killing, lets us know the hell that we human beings of all religions and faiths and ethnicities are capable of. It was a terrible moment. I lay there with my wife next to me wondering, should I wake her and tell her? You know, if it had been George Bush next to me, I would have known the answer. Don't wake her. But my wife, it was a legitimate question. And I wrestled with it for a while and decided that I live with a certain kind of terror in my life, and so I let her be. And I stayed alone in my isolation, connected with the umbilicus of my earphone to that large, confusing, complex, and painful hell that we human beings are able to make out of the beauty of our genius. There's a Buddhist expression that in life, pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Death is inevitable, but being obsessed by it and terrified by it is optional. Terror, like death, is inevitable. It will happen again there. It will happen again here, and we will all be touched by it in some way. We may be touched with pity, with fear, with anger, with rage, with a sense of wanting revenge, with a sense of being willing to do anything to prevent it from happening, but like death, we cannot prevent it. We can try to prevent some attempts at disrupting the life of society. We can try to analyze where we are vulnerable, but we must not become obsessed by our fear and our terror. As we acknowledge that death is inevitable, we acknowledge that terrorism is inevitable, but being terrified constantly is optional, and we don't need to go there. I think that there are two very oversimplistic analyses that are given to terror in the world today. One from the right in general and one from the left in general, and I think that they are both wrong in general and in specific. From the left, there is this attitude that it must be our fault we did something to them or they wouldn't be calling us. It must be our fault and there must be something that we can do that will ameliorate the conditions that cause their rage. If only the United States would, and fill in the blanks. There are certainly many policies that America could change, but terrorism is not owned by one particular political viewpoint. It can't be ameliorated or bought off or placated by policy changes. There is a rigid truth. The difference between you and me and terrorists is captured in one of the opening readings that Barbara gave. You and I may have a certain modesty about our even deeply held political beliefs. We are willing to ask questions. Am I right? Am I wrong? Is there something I can learn? Let's ask questions and find out from each other. But the terrorist of every stripe, and this is not simply a Muslim problem, and I'll go into that in a bit, but of every stripe does not believe that they haven't touched the hem of the garment of truth. They believe that they have wrapped themselves in the garment of truth and that it protects them and allows them to kill in the name of that immutable truth that they own. So for those that want to solve the problem by changing a policy, it's not going to work. On the right, there are people that say, no, the real problem is it's inherent in Islam. It is this religion of violence and of intolerance, and Judaism and Christianity are just completely different in their DNA. I must tell you, this is nonsense, and you can only hold this position if you know absolutely nothing about history. Every religion is capable of being hijacked or characterized by its very worst. And every religion is, or political philosophy, is capable of allowing people to grab onto one point and to hammer that as the one thing that they must do and that they must achieve. And so they believe that our way of life is being attacked by the great Muslim world as if that were a monolith. It's no more a monolith than Christianity is a monolith. Muslims, and particularly right now, Muslims are killing Muslims as Christians in World War II and World War I, in the Hundred Years' War and the 30 Years' War, had very few compunctions about killing fellow Christians. It is in the DNA of humanity, not in the particular DNA of one faith. So when people say, well, look, the Muslims have done all of these terrible things in the world, we must say some Muslims, not the Muslims. We do not say to all of Christendom that you, every Christian, perpetrated the Holocaust. Every Christian in Christianity was responsible for the Crusades or for the Inquisition. There is no inherited and general guilt to these large religions. It is as one fellow has talked about, the Jews killing Christ. All Jews, all Christians, all Muslims, there is a small but disproportionately powerful sect in Islam, followers of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, who was a 18th and 19th century reformer, the angry Jonathan Edwards of Islam. And he wanted to purify Islam. He wanted to cut out 1,000 years of Muslim philosophy and history and political discourse and science and go back to the religion of Muhammad. Those critics who say Islam needs to experience an enlightenment forget that Islam went through the enlightenment before Christianity did. And the lesson of today is that there are those militant, violent fundamentalists of all stripes who would turn out the lights and who can turn out the lights and who are trying to turn out the lights, and they can be Muslims and they can be Christians and they can be Jews and they can be people who are willing to give your all for their cause and their rage and their fierce certainty, since they are cloaked in truth. It is a frightening world. But we must not be frightened into the panic that objectifies an entire faith with the rage of the Wahhabis, who don't like to be called Wahhabis, they like to be called Salafis or Salufis. Can't even agree on Salafi or Salufi, and I'm ready to call the whole thing off. But that's a very small sect, but it is disproportionately loud and powerful because it has a disproportionate amount of money. Now, I know that this gets into areas that are semi-political, but since I'm not here today and I'm on vacation, I'm going to be able to say this. The Saudis have spent over $70 billion since 1975 in propagating the Wahhabi branch of Islam. It is a small branch within the larger sect of the Sunni. And it doesn't represent Islam, and it doesn't represent the Sunni. It represents the followers and the fierce fundamentalism, the violent fundamentalism of followers of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab. And that's who they represent. And that money has gone out to mosques, to prison programs in the United States, to various ways of disseminating an angry and intolerant message. Then the other side of politics now. George W. says something that is true. He says they hate our freedom. Well, they do. Fundamentalists of all stripes hate freedom. They hate our movies. They hate our music. They hate our sexual promiscuity. They see us as decadent and unworthy of having power and maybe unworthy of living. They don't want to change our policy. They want us to change our religion to theirs or to die. It's like the scene in Goldfinger where Bond is strapped to the table and the laser's coming up between his legs. And he says to Goldfinger, "You expect me to talk?" And Goldfinger says, "No, Bond, I expect you to die." Those are the stark options. It really isn't a question of negotiation. There is a cancer. And that cancer can be put in remission, and I believe that to some extent old Al-Qaeda was put in remission in Afghanistan, but America sometimes suffers from international attention deficit disorder, and so took our eyes off of Afghanistan and decided that Iraq looked like an interesting place. And it's coming back in Afghanistan, and it has already sent out the seeds of its metastases from a centrally kind of located place of Al-Qaeda, where now it is not this institution, but it is this disseminated cancer that is sprouting a toxic weed all across the world. Now, there are several models that people use for treating cancer, and they have good points and bad points. But one of the common effects of chemotherapy, being itself toxic, is that you can kill the body in trying to kill the cancer. That's a mistake in the large world that we have. To identify the cancer as Islam is a mistake. To try to wipe it out with simply the chemotherapy way, in the model of war, while war may play and violence may play a part, it will not control the problem. What is feeding and has been feeding it has been money. And we seem unwilling to look at Saudi Arabia, at oil, at our dependence, at the relationships, at all of those things. There's not a simple solution here. I'm not saying bomb Saudi Arabia. I almost said Saudi America. They actually come up with that corporation. What I am saying is that we can wander around in very many places in the world, but one of the most effective things we can do is financial, and we haven't. We are easily distracted. We want to look at brown-skinned, swarthy men because they have been largely responsible for most of these outrages, most of these hells on earth. But the next generation can be blonde hair and blue eyes and converts. This is simply an organizing principle for the anger, the rage, the impotence, the discontent around the world. And almost everybody in almost every country can find something to be angry and offended and alienated about. This has got to be a multi-pronged response that we give. But we must not be trapped into simply going after, as generals are famous for doing, the last war. Looking at brown-skinned people with Arab names is not the answer to the problem. Changing our policies out of fear is not the answer to the problem. Being afraid, being very afraid, is not an answer to the problem. The problem will always be with us now in this age of technology, in this time when people can Google any perversity and create an affinity group, where the technology to create 10 pounds of explosives is, never mind the weapons of mass destruction, is readily available. Terrorism is here to stay. We will not in our lifetime see green again. Yellow is the new green, for those fashionistas here. Yellow is the new green. Remember that. We may change the system, but the fact is we are vulnerable, and that's what terror lives on and thrives on. It's on our willingness to be terrified. Actuarially, we're in really pretty good shape. How many more of us are killed in automobile accidents than in 9/11? Or in gunplay than in 9/11? How many millions and millions are dying in Africa from dehydration because we're not taking care of the water? The things that are likely to get us are not related to our fear. And I know that this is a 9/11 cliche that I'm moving to 7/7. But when we allow ourselves to be terrified and to hate and to be suspicious of everyone that looks different or worships differently, the terrorists win. One of the most interesting things that has gone on in Iraq, if you can call any of that tragedy to be interesting, is that the Sunnis and the Sunni Baathists, non-religious, and the Wahhabis have been killing Shia trying to provoke a civil war. And the Shia have not played. They haven't yet, some say. It's true, yet. At some point, I was going to say that the Wahhabis will live to regret it, but they may not live to regret it. We must not be provoked into being terrorized by terror. We have choices about this. As I was laying there at 2:30 in the morning, Hamlet's words came into my head, and he was speaking about death. And he said of death, "If it is not now, it will be to come. If it is not to come, it will be now. The readiness is all." That we will be attacked by someone is inevitable. That we respond with fear and chronic rage and xenophobia is not inevitable. Those are choices that we have. There are people who live and die on our Gulf Coast and in Florida. There are hurricanes coming with forces really beyond human imagination. Some evacuate, some stay there and hammer on plywood onto their homes. If their homes are destroyed, they come back and they rebuild them. They understand that they can't control hurricanes. They live and die with them, but they can be prepared. They can be prepared physically, and they can try to be prepared emotionally. The people in London knew that it was when, not if. And they were prepared with an infrastructure as best they could, not perfectly, but they were prepared, and they got up the next morning and got back to life. I don't believe that they will create a civil war that they will run in large numbers, rampant against the Muslim community, most of whom are innocent. When it happens here, will we be physically prepared, as our compatriots in the Gulf Coast, and will we be emotionally prepared to weather the storm and to keep ourselves, yes, afraid, but not terrorized, not allow it to change who we are and how we are in our world and in our hearts? It's an open question, but we have the power to influence its answer.